There are no small jobs here at the Bureau of Standards. You may hear that and wonder how it can be true, but not that long ago I was standing right where you are now. I was given a position in fuel purity, just over there. I found an entry on a Varnesian input account that didn't match. 200 Covarn charging rods. Doesn't seem like much, does it? Well, I walked it back. Every shift I make time for my quota to dig just a little bit deeper. And one day, after months of searching, screens started lining up across the room. I had uncovered a cabal of corrupt purchasing agents who were stealing Imperial supplies in 4 sectors. There is a future here for those who dare.
All right, welcome back to the Logic Gate podcast, or as affectionately we've been calling it off microphone, Doug Hates Weddings. So,
just Chandrillon.
Just Chandrillons?
Yeah.
Do you guys not want to talk about Andor today? We can just literally spend 45 minutes talking about weddings.
Weddings are the worst.
They're the worst. All right. I'm your host, Scott, and I'm joined by my two friends, Jason.
That's me.
And Douglas.
I hate Chandrillon weddings.
There we go. Off with a bang. All right. So today we're discussing Andor season 2, episode 2, which, again, I don't know. You guys know the title of this episode?
Sagrona Tima.
Okay, interesting. I wrote that down a little bit. We can talk about that. All right, I want to group, or I want to talk about this podcast in 1, 2, 3, 4-ish sections. So I think there's essentially 4, maybe 4.5 plot lines going on in this episode. So I want to focus, at least on the beginning, on the rebels. So when we last left Cassian, he was on, and I forget the planet's name, he crash landed and the rebels basically accosted him and tied him up. So the episode opens, we see the rebels they're crawling around in the rain and the mud, and they're looking for someone. And I wrote down the name Rika. Do you guys, I assume that they were looking for like their past leader that either got, you know, eaten by one of the dinosaurs or ran away. Do you know what exactly they were looking for at the beginning?
Yeah, I think they were just looking for the bodies of the people that got shot, you know.
From the last,
just, yeah, when they did nobody the in particular. I think probably just to like collect their bodies and maybe whatever they had on them, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, because the last episode ended with them shooting at each other over an argument of basically leadership, right?
Yeah, so that's what we see when the episode opens, is that there's 2 clearly defined factions of 8 each, 10 each, something like that.
Give or take, yeah.
And they're fighting with each other. They're basically jockeying. They're still jockeying to see who is going to be a leader, and then, more importantly, how they're going to get off the planet. We see that the rebels they're basically starving. They've been on this planet for, we don't know how long, but long enough that they don't have any water left in there, down to their last couple moldy rations. We see Cassian is tied up on one of the ships, so they have subdued Cassian and restrained him on... He's restrained on the non-TIE fighter ship, which comes into play later. Then the rebels are actually... They're arguing with each other because they're trying to figure out what they're going to do and who's going to fly the ship, because Cassian is the only pilot out of all of these people. So their only hope to get off the planet is to get Cassian to fly them out of here, or for them to come up with some other pilot.
Yeah, just real quick, when they find the body, or when they're looking for the bodies, they only find like a foot or like a boot. Is it a boot with the foot in it? Or
they find a boot, and then one guy yells, "Why didn't you bring the boot back?" And she was like, "Oh, well, you know, Bob's leg was still in it, and I didn't really want to have to deal with the leg and the boot."
Yeah, so some animal thing happened there. It looks like, you know.
We do see a dinosaur-looking thing, a big gigantic lizard like the size of a hippo later in the episode runs out of the forest and just snipes one of them and takes them off and kills them. So the main plot point I think here that we're seeing is we have 2 factions of rebels who are fighting with each other. And at one point, they tie ropes around the, what do we call in that TIE fighter ship? That the
prototype.
Yeah, the prototype Empire ship. They're trying to manually turn the ship to aim it at the other faction so they can shoot at them.
I just want to go back, because this is an important point. It's not prototype. It's proto-tie, because it's a TIE fight. Proto-tie.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
Just wanted to make that clear.
We see them. So I'm not really sure what the take here is. I mean, they're going to turn the ship and then use the guns to blow up the other faction, which, I mean, I guess it's a strategy. But again, Cassian's the only pilot. So if you blow up the other faction, you're SOL stuck on this planet. Also, if they don't have a pilot, are they even going to know how to operate the weapons? Who knows? I guess, well, they do, because they do shoot the lasers into the forest. So maybe somebody else knows how to. Anyway, the point is
they're not the smartest group of folks.
So the takeaway is they're very unorganized.
Yeah.
They don't seem to have a plan. They've clearly been out here for days and days because they're starving. And they still have no real plan on how they're going to get off this planet.
I think it's mostly just to highlight and showcase just how untrained, unorganized, and lacking leadership this early rendition of the rebellion is. Like, it's just a bunch of dumb people who have no idea what they're doing.
Who are just angry at the man for oppressing them. Right.
For sure.
Yeah, I think this is probably the weakest aspect of the first three episodes. It seems to go on. I mean, it does end in this episode. I think he leaves in this episode, so we don't see a ton of it, but it does seem like a long diversion for what amounts to, could have been an email, you know, I don't know.
Oh, really? I mean, I liked it from the aspect that Doug said, is that you see the seeds of this rebellion. Clearly that's what Cassian's trying to build towards, but there is no structure. There's no plan at all.
It seems like they needed some way to, like, delay Cassian, you know, to have the threat on the Mina Rao farming planet with Bix and the Empire. And so that this is sort of their conjuring of a way to, like, delay Cassian, as well as show the Yavin Rebel planet for a little bit.
I don't want to get too far ahead, but I feel like this actually plays into a plot point later in a future episode. But I don't want to get into spoilers for those who haven't watched ahead further.
I've only watched the two episodes. But I'm slow burning this on purpose.
So. It is notable that Cassian is right in the middle of this, witnessing their incompetence and lack of leadership. That does come into play later.
And you see him, like, even reluctantly, or being pulled into giving leadership commands to these folks, like, set up a perimeter.
Right. You know, collect the water.
Yeah. And so he's like, you can see him taking on that role of leadership just because he recognizes that there's, you know, it's needed and he can give it. So
there's a clear leadership vacuum that he's reluctantly being forced to fill.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great way to show a reluctant leader being born. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We see there's some fog mist on the planet. And then at one point, you know, one of the factions hears some yelling. We see a bunch of, laser blasts fly out from the mist. One of the factions is trying to take advantage of the cover. I mean, this just goes back and forth that these two groups have no idea what they're doing with each other. At one point, one of the factions yells, "Kill the pilot." That'll get you out of here, because they're basically saying, you know, hey, watch where you're shooting. Cassian's our only hope. So the rebels come up with this genius idea where they all meet out in the middle of this battlefield, and they leave Cassian behind, tied up in this one ship, which is important later. And there's, whatever, six from each faction in the middle of this field, and they all go out and they set their weapons down. You know, like, I kept expecting, you know, one of them to get punchy and start another fight, but it doesn't happen. And they decide, and they agree to play a game called Five Hands with the Roski rules. So
we all know that.
And right? That's, I mean, yeah, that's,
we're very familiar, that's so obvious with the Roski rules. Is. I mean,
they kind of like slow burn that too. I'm like, oh, what's this going to be? Oh, and at one point he says, pick a second. So I'm expecting it to be like a duel or a fist fight. Yeah. Like, mm-hmm. you know, this is going to be, you know, last man standing, that person gets to be the leader kind of thing. And then fast forward like 30 seconds and they're just freaking playing rock, paper, scissors is essentially what they're doing. I mean, is there more to it?
No,
they're just making it's weird
five hands, man.
It's
five hands with the Roski rules. Get it straight.
I mean, they're in each other's face. They're like 2 feet apart and they're like making snake hands and I don't even know. They're just, anyway.
Yeah.
It's just silly. Like they've been literally trying to like shoot each other with lasers for days and they're like, hang on, guys. Change of plans. Let's do a little rock, paper, scissors.
Wait, so you can point out the stupidity of cultural customs, but when I do it, it's suddenly I hate weddings?
No, it's because Broski or whatever. What did I call it? Five hands is dumb. Weddings are great. We'll get to that later.
Chandrill and weddings are dumb.
Okay, so we cut back to Cassian. He's still tied up on the ship. And somehow, and I did note, he's on the non-TIE fighter ship, and he kicks the wall and basically opens this drawer.
Did you mean the prototype?
Yeah, that's fighter. He's on the non-prototype ship. He kicks the wall, and this drawer pops open that just happens to have a gun, like, well within his range. Like, number one, how did he know that was there? Number two, why would you leave a gun there anywhere near where you have a dude tied up? Mm-hmm. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Kicks this guy. Cassian gets this gun, basically tells the guy that's guarding him to stand down or he'll shoot him. Cassian runs off into the forest, he starts to run off into the forest. And then the five hands game gets interrupted by a big gigantic dinosaur that comes through and eats one of the competitors.
It's a Yavinian Dudar. So get that straight.
Oh, well, I just thought that was obvious. Everyone knew that. So okay. I didn't bother to say that.
Just for those that don't.
It's embarrassing that you even had to bring that up, to be honest with you.
Why is it called five hands?
Well, I don't. Like, that's a good question.
Where does the five come from?
I don't know, man. Because they each, it was 1v1, and then they each had a second. It was four people playing, right?
Right.
Snake. You know what? I want to look it up. I bet you $10. There's probably like real five hands rules on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure.
Wikipedia or something.
All right. So just to wrap up the Rebel plot line here, Cassian frees himself. Guy gets eaten by a dinosaur. Cassian runs to the proto-tie. And there is a...
Thank you for that.
A guard or a... I was going to say pilot, but he's clearly not. There's one guy left on the prototype, and Cassian sees him and straight up executes him. So I wrote down Cassian shoots first. There was zero hesitation. Cassian, he's like, I'm getting on this ship. I don't care who gets in my way. Executes the guy and then flies off into sunset, the atmosphere, and that's it. That's the end of the Rebel plot. Anything... You guys that I missed? Anything else worth talking about on the Rebel plot line?
Well, we see, you know, as he's flying away, it's revealed that it's Yavin, the planet of Yavin, because we see that temple, you know, as he's flying away.
Oh, I didn't notice
that's,
that temple.
That's how we know it's the Jedi. It is a Jedi temple, I guess, but it's that classic, you know, temple that's on the Rebel base.
Wait, I did not put that together, really? Yeah, that's a Jedi thing? I had no idea. I just figured it was some native structure in the middle Jedi, of the forest.
We're looking at it now, but it's basically like an ancient Jedi temple that is on Yavin.
It looks like a pyramid, like Egypt style, right? Yeah.
Yep. And that's sort of, I don't know, the classic silhouette of the Rebel base. That's how we know. But
okay. No, I didn't catch that. That's a good point, though.
Okay, so just to clarify. So the planet that they've been on the entire time is Yavin?
Yeah. Yep.
Which... Okay, stupid question. Where does Yavin fit into the larger Star Wars universe? It's not in any of the movies, is it?
It's the headquarters of the secret Rebel base.
Yeah, it's the one they're looking for.
Okay, all right.
In the first movie, they're found out, and then they have to go to Hoth. So that's
what I was gonna, but I mean, there's never like a scene where they're on Yavin. Name mentioned, but I don't remember actually seeing it.
There is small shots of Yavin in the original trilogy. I don't know. It's very quick, though. Yeah, there's not like full scenes. Yeah.
Okay, so the point is that Yavin, for the Star Wars people with background, know that that's ultimately where the Rebel base, or probably where the rebellion starts. Is that what we're taking away from this?
Yes.
Or at least that's where the faction is in the original trilogy. Okay.
Yep.
I did not know
where that. The Battle of Yavin takes place by the way.
Hang on. Let me write that down. So the Battle of Yavin takes place where?
On this planet. That's called Yavin.
Oh, okay. Did you write that down, Doug?
Actually, while you guys were discussing the Battle of Yavin, I looked up the rules for Five Hand. suffice it to say, it's stupid. It is basically rock, paper, scissor. But the point is, it was crafted by actor Sam Gilroy.
Really?
Gilroy.
Is that the actor? Because one of the leaders, actor is Sam Gilroy. Gilroy. I don't know if
he's a Gilroy.
Is that the one?
I don't know if he's one of the Gilroys, but...
There's so many Gilroys. I am a Gilroy. So
you think Tony just calls up his cousin? He's like, hey, I need you to come be an extra. Oh, by the way, can you make up a fake game real quick?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. All right. One of the other plot lines is we see a... What do you want to call it? I wrote down this is like a farming community. Like they've got like a little, like a farmer's market kind of store. We see there's some farmers and they are, I can only assume, harvesting wheat. There is a lot of discussion between these farmers that, is it ever... I don't know if they ever used the word empire, but it's implied that the empire is cracking down on illegal. They say the word illegals.
Yep. Yeah. It's they say the empire. I mean, it's obvious.
I mean,
later on.
Okay. Yeah. So what do we know? Do we know what planet they're on or where this is?
It's Mina Rao. So not one I've been familiar with at all before this, but that's what it's called. And yeah, it's like a farming planet. You know, the obvious message here is there's a lot of migrant workers, that may not have the correct paperwork, and you have a fascist government coming in and, making sure everything's straightened out while also extricating people that they don't approve of, So I can't imagine anything that's reality there, but...
Super softball of reality, wait, right?
So they're enforcing immigration and customs.
Well, you could even make an acronym about that. I don't know what it would be, but
to be fair, the empire never actually says what they're doing. They're there. He's like, we're cracking down on illegals. They never say anything about why or what. They just kind of show up. So I wrote down that the military arrives, the empire, they show up in two hover cars, I guess, but they're very clearly out of place, I should say, because we're looking at a farming community. You're looking at these huge fields of wheat, and then you basically have two tanks that kind of show up, and they make all of the farmers nervous just because they're out of place. There is discussion about who's illegal and who's not. Bix is on this planet. She's recovering. One of the Empire guards really creepily hits on Bix, basically, hey, what are you doing later? I know this really cool restaurant over across the wheat fields. And one of the other farmers basically shows up and kind of gets the guy to back off, and he calls her Zala. So clearly Bix is going by a different name, or she's undercover, because I'm sure she's probably got a reputation after the Ferex altercation. So she's probably on their radar, which is
because she was in their custody, being tortured, and so she's known. And she also mentions that her husband is off world to that empire guy, just saying that her husband's not there. So
she's not married, right? I just assume she was lying to the guy to get him to stop hitting
her.
Yeah, no, he was giving off creepy rapist vibe. I'm not allowed to say that anymore. Grapist vibes.
Well,
That's kind of the extent of the farm plot. I mean, clearly they're building for something much bigger that's going to happen here. But at least on this episode, it's just that the Empire shows up, starts making people nervous. They talk about how they're going to hide or what they're going to do if the Empire shows up. There was discussion of those new big silos. Oh, those new silos. I don't know if they're going to work out.
Yeah, and there's this guy Kellen is his name, and he's been helping them, sort of giving them hints and telling them. He actually recommends they don't run because there were some other runners that got caught. He, I believe, is the owner of this farm, and so I think he's sort of helping them out. So that is important to note.
Okay, that's all the notes I have on the farm plot line. Anything else? That was kind of a shallow part of this episode.
Yeah, not much. Not much happens, really.
I feel like this is kind of just establishing, these are where our main characters right. are this, and what they're up to.
Early in the season, we want to make sure you know where the people ended next. Yes.
Yeah.
One of the other plot lines sort of revolves around, I want to say the Empire, but that's not the right word. Like, it's specifically like Daedra and her day job, I guess is the right word. So there was discussion on the last episode about how the Empire needs the, I forget what the crystal, they need the Kalkite. Energy that's on the Gorman planet. And Daedra proposes you can't just go in with a PR campaign. You need some boots on the ground. So at the last episode, she makes some comment about you basically need to stir up an insurgency so that we have an excuse to go into this planet and extract what we need. We can't just, she's manufacturing a political crisis, or she suggests manufacturing a political crisis so that they have an excuse to go in.
I don't fully understand her plan, like how it's so. So what type of rebels is she saying that they need to, like, inject rebels in there? Like the actual rebels? Because those aren't really available. They're not even organized or...
We're not talking about Empire and rebels. I think we're just talking about, like, malcontents on the planet.
Yeah.
That I think the impression I got was that she wants to stir up unrest on the planet so that the Empire, and I'm hypothesizing here, that the Empire has an excuse to go in and essentially declare martial law and say, look, you guys can't get your crap together. Big Daddy Vader's here to get you back in line. And, you know what? Since we're here, we're just going to take your Kalkite because screw you. That's the impression I get.
Yeah, no, I think you're pretty spot on with that.
So, but the interesting thing here is, and Daedra is having a discussion with, I don't know what that guy's name is, but at the very beginning, he basically says, hey, this Gorman plan, it's a blessing. Like, this can be your, you know, golden goose to raise you up in the Empire. But she specifically says, I don't want the Gorman job. She's not excited about it. I think it's going to be dirty. And she's kind of got a little bit of a stink on her from the Ferrix affair because they did not end up catching Cassian. So they went to all this effort and it didn't wind up the way she wanted. So I think she's nervous about trying to do something similar on Gorman.
Well, she has put a lot of work into this Axis theory of hers, which is Luthen. Like she's pretty on his tail. She's collected a lot of evidence and sort of put the pieces together, but she hasn't been able to prove enough of it for the Empire to give her the leeway to pursue it, seems like. But that seems to be her passion, is the Axis theory that she's got going on, which is pretty close to what's happening.
I mean, that was her passion in season one, right? Yeah. I mean, that was her whole deal, was I want to bust, in essence, Luthen.
Yeah.
And she never gets there.
Well, yeah. She never identified that it was Luthen. She thought it was right. Cassian.
Okay, sure.
Right, yeah.
She's expecting there to be some big conspiracy, and basically the Empire is telling her, you know, you need to move on. We've got this Gorman job for you. And she's not super excited about it. Mm-hmm. I assume that they force her into it, but that's not indicated in this episode. We see a quick scene with Cyril, who is now working in the Bureau of Standards, and he's basically talking to the new guy, who, I don't know, the guy looks like he's 19 or whatever, and Cyril's got his uniform, it's all pressed, and his hair is done nicely, and he's talking like really intensely to this kid, and he was like, yeah, you know, just last month I busted these corrupt purchasing agents. He's basically just bragging to this kid in this gigantic room that looks like, I don't even know, Wall Street. I mean, there's like, I don't even know, like 300 cubicles. It's just this really intimidating room. Everything's black and white.
Boring.
Cyril's basically trying to sell the guy on bureaucracy, right?
Well, like, but it's a beautiful, like, juxtaposition from last season when he got busted down and basically kicked out of his security gig and he had to pick up a job in logistics. He was the kid and he was getting a talking to from the senior guy who was all about logistics and standards and this stuff is super important. And he was kind of rolling his eyes going like, this job sucks. But now he's the senior one telling the kid like, this is super important. And just last week I did these super important things. And the kid is kind of like, okay.
Oh, it's so good because you can tell all he really cares about is like power and just having a modicum of little bit of power. And like, he's depressed when he's like being talked to or talked down to and he's just uninspired. But then when he's the leader, you see his eyes start lighting up when he's the one giving the orders, you know. when it's not too much of an intense situation, like when he was trying to give that pep talk to all the soldiers when they were going to go after Cassian in the very early episodes, you know, remember that? He was like kind of froze up. So he's not very good at it, but he's
a glorified middle manager.
He's
right?
A fascist, I mean, he's through just, and through.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, you do bring up a good point. Like, he's kind of flipped 180. So I did not make that connection. But it's worth noting, like, this entire scene is 20 seconds long, 30 seconds long. It's not a major plot point, but that's like Tony Gilroy, like chef's kiss, like painting the scene for these characters, making them more realistic, more three-dimensional than just black and white, good versus evil. You get this like backstory of Cyril being excited about busting these, what I don't remember what it was, spice traders or whatever. So
yeah, no.
So good.
It is.
I liken it to like Coen Brothers, where the stakes are real in a lot of Coen Brothers movies. There's real violence and there's real weight to what's happening, but the characters themselves are comical, but they're not like meant to be comical. You know, they're not like meant to be funny, just that their characteristics come across so glaringly loud that it's so fun to watch, you know, like a Coen Brothers movie.
The last thing that I wrote down on the Daedra Cyril plot line is towards the end of the episode, we see Daedra in her apartment. And she's looking out the window. I don't know where she lives. It kind of looks like Coruscant because it's just such a big, sprawling city. She's looking out the window and sees all these buildings. I mean, it looks like New York, kind of. So wherever she lives is clearly kind of the hub of... She lives in a big city, I should say.
Oh, it's 100% Coruscant.
Is it Coruscant?
Makes sense. But additionally, we talked about Coruscant last season and how there's this... social hierarchy of like the higher up you live, the better view you get, the more light you get. She's got a high rise apartment.
Yes.
Zero was living down in the shadows.
Like, he was basically below ground, wasn't he? If I remember right, or at least.
I mean, he definitely didn't have a good view.
Yeah. So the one thing I noted, and I believe this is the first time we see that in this scene, is Daedra has her hair down and she has long hair, like it's below her shoulders. She's very buttoned up character. She's very, you know, like ironing her suit every day and very by the numbers. So this is, I think, the first time we see literally her with her hair down.
Mm.
So she's at home. The implication here is that she's relaxing in this fancy apartment that she has. And then ding dong, Cyril shows up and he walks in with some bags, which I assume are groceries. It's not really clear. He brings her something. So.
Yeah, this is her like sweatpants hanging out in her, you know, jammies, like lounging around in this buttoned up, collared, tight belt outfit.
That's a really good point. She's at home by herself and she still does look really well put together. But it's, again, worth noting, her hair is down. I think that's the only time we've ever seen her without her hair in a bun. So anyway, Cyril brings her groceries or whatever. It's not clear what he brings her. And he asks her about doing something, and she basically says she has to cancel the plans for whatever they were going to do. There's like this really weird sexual tension between them. Like, I mean, Cyril wants her to bend him over her knee and just spank him silly. Cause like you can, it's just, it's weird. And anyway, they basically end up having to cancel the plans, or Daedra says, I have to cancel the plans. And it leads with, or the scene ends with Cyril saying, tomorrow then? ?
Wait, no, I think you're misinterpreting a little bit. At least the way I took it was that, Daedra's back a little bit early. And Cyril and them had plans to meet with his mom. Sorry, that is a spoiler. But they do have plans for something. And what it is Cyril's like, well, we could pretend you're not back yet, so we don't have to go through with this plan yet. Can we push it out another day or something like that? And they're like, we can't push it out anymore. You know? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, I've not watched ahead at all. So all that's indicated in this episode is that they had plans together, which they discuss canceling, and then Cyril leaves with, well, maybe can we do it tomorrow then? Whatever this big event is. I don't know.
I don't think it's sexual is what I was saying.
It could be.
Could be.
Dude, between those guys, like, have you actually heard, like, I've seen some YouTube clips of those two actors, of the Daedra and Cyril, and like, even they play on it. They're like, dude, it is so clear that our characters were like, had this repressed sexual energy for each other. Like, it's well documented. I thought it was funny just like hearing the actors banter back and forth. Like, okay, clearly Daedra wants to dominate this guy. So that's the end of the Daedra plotline. We're going to get to Doug's favorite topic here, which is the Chandralon wedding. Ooh. So we see, I forget, what are the kids' names? Layda and...
Annoying.
Layda, oh. No. I wrote it down, but I can't find it. Oh, Layda and Stekin are getting married. We are on the Mothma family ranch. We see a lot of wedding planning still going on. Luthen and Clea are sort of clandestinely meeting back and forth at this wedding. Hey, have you heard from Cassian? What's going on with Cassian? Clea reminds him, I cannot use the radio here. It's too risky. Luthen is very concerned about where Cassian is. There's discussion of the gift. It's like a mystery. The gift that the Skuldens are giving, I assume, to the young couple. What's Mon Mothma's husband's name? Perrin. Perrin says he said that you probably figured it out already. It's a Chandi Merle, which I think the implication is it's some kind of statue. And he says it's worth more than the house. So whatever the Skuldens are giving this couple is extremely valuable. And the implication being that they're very wealthy and they're just throwing their money around that they can afford, or they can make a show of giving an expensive, audacious gift that doesn't have any practical purpose. You know, it's a literal golden sheep kind of thing.
Yeah.
Is that the impression that it's not explained exactly what it is, but the line from the episode is it's worth more than the house. So whatever this gift is very valuable because clearly the Mothmas have a very expensive house.
Yeah. Well, it's cool.
It's kind of interesting how it's maybe, you know, it seems like a significant plot point because it's so important to them, the characters, which is interesting at how like legitimate he's drawing up these characters and how much they care about the wealth and like the presence and, you know, and the pageantry and all of these things. So yeah, it's just kind of interesting how
did you draw the conclusions? I mean, it literally just happened between the Bezos and what's her name wedding that was whatever last weekend. I mean, like, how many celebrities and billionaires flew into, where was it, Italy or whatever? I mean, like, there were so many people there. Like, the whole point was to go and get your picture taken that you were at this event, like, that you were an up-and-comer and that you have a seat at this table of Jeff Bezos.
Do
you think they did the traditional hike to the top of the mountain?
Well, we can talk about that, too. So there's a really quick scene where they're all hiking. I mean, Mon Mothma and... Yeah. Zell are like hiking up this mountain with these ceremonial staves.
Yeah. In their full robes.
In their
and
full
everything.
Fancy robes. Yeah. And there was, what did I write down? Yeah. The point was it's a Chandralon custom that you hike to the top of this mountain, and at the top of the mountain there an elder will purify you.
Yeah. And then you got to walk your happy ass all the way back down. You're sweating. You need a shower after that. What else do you want to do? You want to just go lay down, but you can't because you got like 2 days of wedding left.
Yeah. But you know what you get for all that, Doug? You get a Chandi Merle, which is worth more than your house. So maybe getting a little sweaty was worth it.
You really think you would get a Chandi Merle? Okay, Jeff
Bezos. You deserve a Chandi Merle?
Let's see.
Vel hiked up there. You think Vel's getting a Chandi Merle?
Vel's gift is that she gets to be at this wedding and have a seat at the table and get to rub shoulders with these senators that she probably doesn't normally have a chance to talk to.
So
I know you guys aren't social, but like you wouldn't want to go to a party with a bunch of senators
and see them miserable.
Maybe if I had a secret rebel mission and I was trying to infiltrate information.
The backdrop of all of this is the pomp and ceremony of this high society wedding.
Yep.
But the key points that I take away from it, on that hike up the mountain, she's talking to Vel, and Vel's basically like, Cinta and I aren't really a thing anymore.
Oh, I didn't know who she was talking, because I wrote down that Vel says So you said somebody doesn't want to see me anymore.
Right.
She's talking about Cinta?
Yeah, because her and Cinta were tight during the Aldani raid. I think they were girlfriends. I'm not really sure.
No, it was. Yeah, they were.
Okay.
That was documented.
But all that went down. Cinta's just like separated, which comes up. I can't remember if it's this episode. It might be the next one. I don't know.
Let me go through what I wrote down.
Yeah, okay.
Perrin pulls Mon Mothma aside and basically says, hey, I saw you talking to Tay Coleman. You guys are getting really friendly.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And she's like, well, what are you talking about? I mean, yeah, he's my friend. You know, I'm talking to everybody at this party. And Perrin goes, oh, he got really drunk last night. He had to be dragged home or carried home, I think is what he says. And then he literally just to Mon Mothma's face goes, he's your lover, isn't he? Which is like such a weird thing to say to your wife at your kid's wedding. Like, hey, I know we're all here to celebrate our daughter and, you know, put on this big expensive party. Oh, by the way, I'm pretty sure you're banging my buddy Tacoma over here, right?
Yes, but also...
The implication was he was totally okay with it too, by the way. He's like, ah, so hey, how was your night last night? Did you bang Tacoma? And she's like, what? No.
Forgive me, I'm kind of getting episodes mixed up here, but doesn't Tacoma also pull her aside and have a conversation about like, hey, I'm contributing to the rebel cause and I'm not getting anything out of it.
That was my very next note, was that Tacoma pulls Mon Mothma aside and says, hey, I'm really invested in this. I've contributed a lot and I'm not seeing a lot of return on my investment. Where is my seat at the table? What do I get for all of this money that I'm donating, I'm covering for you? You got your money from, I forget the bad guy's name. So it cleared up her financial problems. The bad guy got a wedding for his daughter. Tacoma, big question mark. He's worried about what he's going to get because his ass is on the line if the rebellion gets found out and he's going to get dragged into it.
And who's lurking in the background of all of this, paying attention and hearing? Luthen.
For sure.
Luthen 100% notices the heat kind of coming down on Tacoma. He notices him like speaking up and being, what's the word? Feeling disrespected, feeling underappreciated.
Undervalued, yeah.
So, I mean, to the point that there's Mon Mothma and Luthen actually have a conversation, and Luthen is worried that Tacoma is over-leveraged. He's got a lot of skin in this fight, and he's not getting what he wants, so he may, in essence, flip on us. We don't know what he's going to do. He's not happy. So yeah. Luthen is like keeping an eye on this guy because if this guy flips on us, he's going to rat us all out and we're screwed.
How does the wedding stuff end in this episode?
The last thing I wrote down was, they're basically discussing about Tacoma being over leveraged. And Luthen says the line from the show is, we will find a number. So Luthen is implying that whatever it takes, we'll buy him off and we'll shut him up.
Is that the last scene?
No, the very last scene is what's here on the screen right now. They're at the wedding, what's the pre-wedding dinner called?
The whole damn thing's been a rehearsal ceremony. And
the rolling past Doug's hatred of weddings. We see Perrin gets up in the middle of this, you know, gorgeous ballroom and these two kind of horseshoe-shaped tables and gives the ceremonial father speech. And I thought, it was actually a pretty good speech. He's a really good speaker. What is Perrin's job? Do we know what Perrin's job was?
To be clear, Tacoma doesn't leave in a chauffeured vehicle in this episode?
No.
Okay.
Whatever the Mothmas do, we know Mon Mothma's a senator. Perrin clearly has some. They're rich, right? They're the Cardassians of this universe. Perrin gives this really fancy speech. You know, the Chandralon custom of. The title of the episode was Sagrona. I don't know what that means. It's a Chandralon word for happiness. I don't know. It's not important. But he gives this speech. He basically gives the bride and the groom, the bride and the groom to be this speech of, hey, I know you guys are getting married, but I'm just letting you know there's going to be a lot of hardships and a lot of struggle. And he like leads with that. Then he's like, so you're going to want to find a way to find the rainbows at the end of all this negativity. Which, I mean, it was a good speech. I was impressed with his oratory skills. He uses big words and speaks well, but it felt like a really kind of dark and weird speech you would give to somebody just about to get married. But ultimately, I thought the speech was kind of depressing. he's looking at his daughter and he's looking at his future son-in-law, and he was like, you guys are in for some dark times. Like, it's going to be bad. So you better figure out a way to make yourselves happy.
Yeah. I mean, it adds a new dimension to Perrin as someone who's a little bit more self-aware than we kind of that was led on before. He seems like someone that's just sort of, you know, looking for the luxuries, looking for to enjoy as much as he can. He doesn't really have any responsibilities. He's just trying to have fun. But you know, but this kind of gives you a hint of the harder life that he still has had to deal with. And that's his personal philosophy, is to look for the joy as much as you can, you know, even in those hardships. So that kind of gives that dimension of his personality coming across as being aloof and like non-caring, but he's kind of self-aware about it, which is kind of cool.
Whatever, I'll look him up for next time. Whatever his job is, he's a good orator. So it made me wonder, are both of them senators? Or clearly he's not shy about giving speeches. So that's the end of this episode with the wedding stuff. There's one tiny, tiny scene sort of in the middle where we see Clea. She goes, because she's not allowed to use the radio at the Chandrillon wedding. So whatever she does, she flies back to their shop and turns on the radio. And it's this cool, like, retro analog looking radio with all these LEDs. It's very mechanical looking. And basically you see her looking or listening to see if Cassian is out there and he has made any contact.
Yeah.
So wherever Chandrillon is, it's apparently within flight distance, that in between events at the wedding, she can fly back, check the radio, see if she's heard from Cassian, and then fly back.
Sure.
So that's it. I mean, those are the major plot lines that I wrote down. Is there anything else that I missed?
No, I don't think so. That's not much happens in the episode. It's kind of a filler episode, really. It's just a transition, it seems like.
What happened?
Like, we're still on the farming planet. We're still kind of under the threat of the Empire. I guess Cassian does escape. But like right at the very end, you know, of that scene, it was mostly just them fighting more. The Chandrillon wedding was advanced. Basically, you're getting more info about Tay having cold feet and Luthen's responses, and him, you know, that decision that they have to make, and Mon Mothma trying to protect him. I think, you know, saying she'll pay him off, but So. Other than that, not a whole lot happens.
I did write down one question. The show opened, season one, episode one, with Cassian looking for his sister. And there has basically been almost zero discussion since then about what happened to his sister, right? Like, have there been any other plot lines about where she is, or is he still even looking for her?
Has there been anything beyond that first scene in the first episode? Has there been anything else?
There was that one flashback of when they were kids on that poison planet or whatever, but it's just kind of weird that there's not even a discussion.
I don't know if Cassian has mentioned it ever again.
I don't know. I wrote that down as a note. Like, that was a big plot point season one, and it just seems like it completely got forgotten.
It did. It seems like it. It's more important. The rebel development seems to be the focus, seemed to be more important. But we'll see. I haven't seen past just these first three, so
The other thing I wrote down that we weren't 100% clear on last time is what Mon Mothma's position in the rebellion was officially, because clearly the rebellion is building. We're trying to see in the original trilogy, Mon Mothma launches the Death Star run. Like, she's clearly high up in the rebellion. So I looked her up, and Mon Mothma for years led a double life as both a senator and slowly building the rebellion. She becomes the impetus for the official establishment of the Rebel Alliance after she resigns from the Senate. So I assume that's in Andor coming up soon-ish. And
does it say what year? I'm just curious.
It did not.
She resigns.
So she resigns from the Senate, and then she assumes leadership of the newly established rebellion. So the answer is she does become the official leader of the rebellion. Mm-hmm. The Rebel Alliance, led by her, overthrows the Empire and restores the Old Republic. This is after the original trilogy. She restores the Old Republic as a nascent new republic of which Mon Mothma was its first chancellor. So we know from here that she's starting to build the rebellion. I know from our backstory that she becomes the leader of the rebellion. Ultimately, they become successful, and she becomes the, I assume, de facto leader, the first chancellor of the New Republic. So she is officially the head of the rebellion. That was all the notes I got.
Yeah, you could, I mean, you could look into everything that happens because this is all prequel. It's kind of done, you know, it's all in the mythology. I try not to look in too much in Wikipedia, but I looked up the dinosaur thing, the name of that. But yeah, there's a lot of information that you could figure out what year it happens, and then you could narrow it down to what episode, you know, she resigns as senator and be like, and have that expectation. But
A spoiler online that that's a major plot point in this, and I guess it was a really good scene, like when. I assume she gives some really good speech and steps down from the Senate and says, you guys are all corrupt or whatever. So I do know that's coming, but I don't know any more details. We've gone a little bit long. It is past my lunch break. You want to close with anything, or are we just going to say Logic Gate out and be done?
Well, we gave the other episode a rating, so I think we should keep doing ratings just to be consistent. I'll give it like an 8, you know, because it's a lower impact episode. But still solid, still awesome, Tony Gilroy. So
I'll give it a 7.5 or an 8. I mean, I did write down that, again, the sets, the wedding sets and the costumes of the Chandralon people, like, they really knocked it out of the park. They look rich. The scenes and the sets feel, you know, opulent. I was just impressed at how well everything it appears visually.
It comes across very intense. Even though there's not much happening, it's still, to me, it feels so oppressive and intense. Just that whole sequence with Tay drinking a little bit too much and like just showing a little bit too much emotion, and then Perrin the next day asking about it and, you know, noticing any little social, out of place social elements are like glaring in these scenes. So I think that part of it is pretty well done.
The one thing I was going to ask you, do you get Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton vibes from Mon Mothma and Perrin? Like, they're high politician. I mean, he basically looks at her and says, you're fucking Tacoma, right? Like, how was it last night? And she was like, no, I didn't. But like, again, the implication was he didn't care, right? I mean, like Bill Clinton and the whole Monica Lewinsky. I mean, it all came out and Hillary was basically like, well, boys will be boys kind of thing. Like, that's the cost of being married to someone that powerful, is that you may have to put up with crap like that.
Sure. Yeah. No, it does seem like it's a social situation where they're playing the parts and they don't really have a real relationship. They're playing their roles in a strict society, you know.
Yeah. I guess you could make that same analogy for Trump and Melania, right? I mean, there's all kinds of implications that they don't have a particularly romantic relationship. I mean, it's a business relationship. Like, you know, I want to be powerful and this is what the cost is, and it is what it is.
Sure. Yeah. I think it applies to any sort of royalty as well. It's a pretty common situation, just well depicted. So
I mean, power corrupts and absolute. No, what is it? Power corrupts absolutely, and absolute power corrupts, something like that. I mean, anybody that gets power, it's not going to end well. Usually,
shame me once, you're not going to shame me again. All right.
Logic Gate out.